what the writer's strike means for television going forward. Where are the characters of HBO's Barry now? What is the HBO Max show Love and Death doing great? And what's it not doing so great? Lastly, do you have the stomach for the outrageous scene of Somebody Somewhere's second episode?
Take projection.
Hey, it's Taking It Down, where we prompt conversations for thoughtful, busy TV devotees from these irreverent outsiders. Welcome to this week's show. We're the TV podcast produced by the Alabama Take website. I'm Blaine Duncan, editor-in-chief of the site. I just can't help dissecting why I like what I like and why I dislike what I dislike when it comes to TV and movies and more. With an English degree and a side hustle as an English teacher, I'll try my best to offer insight that you can use for conversation with others or even with us. Luckily, my ideas aren't the only set of viewpoints on the podcast each week, as with me are these hosts. Adam Morrow is an erudite traveling and studio musician with a penchant for fine literature. Donovan Reinwald, a media specialist with encyclopedic knowledge on film and more. And Natalie Morrow, the first person to ask about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyoncé's music. From us, you'll get the obvious and the obscure. We are here for the TV and streaming obsessed who are just too busy for anything more than the show or movie itself. We'll give the outside of Hollywood analysis, and like a lot of the Alabama Take productions, it comes with zero Southern stereotype. Let's get into the show. So the Writers Guild of both Hollywood and the East Coast are involved in a strike, which has lasted about a week now. It's a complex bit of news, really, for me, because it kind of boils down to the writers not being as compensated. That's like the biggest aspect of it, if I'm not mistaken. Movies and television shows obviously need writers, but their wages and like compensation they'd normally get from royalties, like off reruns, from the way things worked before streaming, like that's just stagnated or even dropped in some cases. And streaming doesn't have to pay for those royalties. So it kind of makes sense that there is a strike. Seasons of shows are much shorter too, with all streaming, and even on broadcast, they've shortened them in many cases. I think there's this idea that writers can't write but for like one show at a time. They're kind of contracted. They aren't allowed to be on the set of the show that they're writing for. In some cases, that might have been a COVID thing that's been carried over for a bit too long. All kinds of reasons for this strike, but if we had to boil it down to anything, it's the same old, same old. CEOs make billions and writers make paltry amounts. It's about the labor. And Natalie messaged me earlier in the week and said, do we want to talk about it? You know, we are a TV and streaming podcast. That's like our forte. We are not an Inside Hollywood kind of podcast. In fact, that's also part of our forte. We give you that sort of average Joe, hopefully intellectual bit of analysis. But so what is there anything you guys wanted to add to that?
I always like a good strike.
Hey, I'm for it. Yeah, strike. Get what you need. I'm for it. I'm part of a labor union, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
I'm solid. My dad told me when I was growing up, I always support the union. I think he's gotten away from that idea, but but he said it, and now it's stuck, so all right.
It's going to be interesting in a couple of, within the next year or two, what shows are affected by it. Because, you remember back mm-hmm. when it was like 2007, 2008, that strike, and like when you rewatch mm-hmm. shows from that era, it's like, this is a weird short season. Something weird has happened in this time. So it's going to, like, House of the Dragon's going to potentially be affected. I don't think Severance is ever coming back, honestly. This may be the final wow. nail in that coffin.
It took effect immediately with Saturday Night Live this past weekend.
Yeah.
It had to cancel. The late night shows are running reruns.
Yep.
The longest strike ever for writers was in the 89. It was like 153 days, and that, if you look at what happened, that's when reality TV became kind of a thing, I guess you would say. And you're talking about the one in, what, was it 07, 08?
Yeah.
And if you watch Breaking Bad, that's the one show I remember being, you can pinpoint where the strike affects it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It hit The Office, too, I remember, because The Office was still on TV and I was watching it, and it's just a very weird short season, like Natalie said. Like,
yeah, especially for broadcast, even back then, they were still 22 episodes a season. Mm-hmm. Not so much now.
Except for this one.
Except for that one. That one lasted 100 days, and it boosted reality television, too. Like, if you look at those numbers, suddenly there's more reality TV, even more. That's probably going to be a reverberation of this one. I bet we end up seeing cheaper to make television with, or television you can make without writers.
Probably.
Are those shows made without writers, though?
Wink, wink.
Yeah, unscripted.
There's also this notion that you could, if the executives feel like they've got the show in the can already, that they might push ahead and try to make it. It's a writer strike only. You know, directors and actors could still continue.
Improv, so many actors are writers. So many directors are writers.
Exactly.
I've seen there's been like studio pressure, like showrunners cannot stop their work. But mm-hmm. so many of them started as writers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are they going to cross the picket line?
Yeah.
You know?
Their management now.
We'll see. The immediate effects, of course, are the live stuff, Saturday Night Live and the late night shows, which really, you know, we rarely mention those things. But the other things might be, if depending on how long the strike lasts, it could be in December or January of next year. If our memory will last, we'll try to think, are we saying this about that show because of that strike that happened? And hopefully it'll be short and everyone can get, not everyone, the writers can get what they want. Speaking of writers.
Should we just go on strike?
Yeah, are we on strike? We're not on strike. We're not even paid.
We're definitely not writing anything.
No, we are not. But scripted TV, some of the best. We got Barry. We're checking on Barry. Bill Hader and Alec Berg on HBO. It's coming in for its landing for its fourth season. We got the titular Barry busted out of jail thanks to a really horrible attempt on his life from a unnamed character played by Fred Armisen. Well, I think he is named because Fred Armisen's playing a hitman / podcaster, which is right up our alley.
Killing Barry, they record on Thursday, so Killing Barry won't interrupt their recording schedule.
That's so good. Barry, the series, is taking a lot of hits at some things that are near and dear to our hearts. We'll get into some of that. But Barry, the character, quickly able to suss out that Armisen's hitman was, / podcaster, was there to murder him. And in Barry fashion, he kills everyone in the room and the doors open for him to escape. Right there in this weird room at prison.
Special housing or something like that?
That's right. Yeah, as Fugues keeps calling it. I suspected pretty early on with this episode we're going to talk about that Barry wouldn't be in it in the fourth episode. You could kind of tell that was going to be the rhythm of the show. He wasn't going to crop up. I didn't think at all, but he's in
the I honestly minute. Was surprised when he showed up in the last minute.
I kind of was too. I thought they would pump the brakes on his appearance, but no. And by the way, spoiler alert, I hope everyone listening got that idea that we're going to spoil.
Big spoil.
Yeah. I'll go through character by character. I'll let Donovan, you comment. I think.
Absolutely.
I'll start with negative and go way positive. I think Jim might be wearing on me. That character, you know, he's one note purposefully, you know, mm-hmm. big, tough, scary Jim, the menace there, blended with comedy. It's such a balance that the show pulls off. But I think I need something from him that would draw me into what he's doing for the show mm-hmm. other than just stalking Barry.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would agree with that. I actually kind of forgot he was in this episode. That's how much I think about him. Mm-hmm. I mean, and he is in the episode, and it moves some stuff along, like with Cousineau going to the cabin or whatever the place is.
Yeah,
that's cabin. And so it moves some stuff along, and it was funny when he roughed up the writer from Vanity Fair. But I think we haven't seen where it's going yet, and maybe they could speed it up a little.
He does feel like a end game boss now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, this is who Barry's got to come face to face with.
He's got to eventually outsmart him or outrun him or whatever.
Yeah, the final antagonist. It was very enjoyable that viewers are in the moment with a lot of these characters in, mm-hmm. in the show. When you remove Bill Hader from the script, from being on screen as Barry, you kind of put in Hank and Jean's shoes, like, oh God, is that Barry behind me?
Yeah.
It's not really played as horror, but it's just fun to be put in their shoes in that way. And then you get Hank and Jean making these life-altering mistakes, I'd say.
This is just an overall thought about the episode, but I thought, and I liked the episode a lot, and I thought it showed how strong of a show Barry is, mm-hmm. honestly, that they were able to take Barry out, and it was still gripping, mm-hmm. and yeah, had Jean and NoHo Hanks, huge, huge decisions, huge things happen. Especially for NoHo Hank.
Right. Who
probably for Gene, too.
Yes. Gene shoots his own son.
Yes.
By mistake. His son's bringing him food.
From that place that he asked him to deliver up at the cabin. It's whatever he wanted food from.
This is the great, one of the many great things about Barry is when I tell you this out loud, it's going to be so much funnier than the way it is displayed on the screen. In the moment, it's kind of played for shocks, but he was shot with the gun Rip Torn gave Gene Cousineau. When you say that out loud, it's just hilarious.
Isn't that the gun that last season he tried to use on Barry and it fell apart?
Yes. His hands? Yeah, it finally works, unfortunately, at the wrong time. Also funny that the knock that Hader takes against comic book movies in this episode with the... You get the fledgling actress in a superhero movie with really bad lines. And boy, did it feel like a punch to Marvel getting Chloe Zhao to direct such a shitty Marvel movie.
Absolutely. And it was, you know, it was pretty on the nose humor, but I did like the director being like, when they watch this movie, they'll know this was by the director, whatever her art house
Coda.
Film is. Coda.
Yeah, award-winning. Yeah, and that was really her. Yeah. You get Chloe Zhao directing one of the worst Marvel movies with Eternals, and she had directed one of the best movies of the previous year with Nomadland, mm-hmm. or the couple of years. Even Sally's constant selfishness there in that scene doesn't help Hollywood that's centered on looks. Barry manages to dig into a lot of that Hollywood stuff that even middle America might find amusing to poke at. Even a layman might relate to. Streaming's really vague way of handling what they should, you know, push. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood's attention to the superficial, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to beyond the West Coast.
I thought I had, is it Sarah Goldberg that plays?
That's right.
I really loved, she's acting really well this season, I think.
Yeah.
She's got more to do than ever before. And I really, really liked, it's just a small little thing when she is doing the monologue to try and purportedly try and help the actress through.
Mm-hmm.
The way she turns around and just stares at the director doing the monologue
and steps in the really, line of sight
is really funny. It was really good. And she just, I don't know, there's something about the way like she pulled it off. Like I'm always kind of fascinated when like actors are acting at acting.
Yeah. Sometimes you know? I can be, yes. Shows about, when you have television shows about television or you hear a song about songwriting, I can get bored with those pretty quickly.
But, mm-hmm.
but Barry's managing to do it quite well balanced. Very interesting, yes. Intriguing, yeah. The Hank and Cristobal stuff.
Man.
Pretty jarring.
There was one of my favorite jokes came from out of that where they raided the Dave and Buster's.
They thought that they were just going to be in the Dave and Buster's all the time.
They got a tip from an informant that it was their headquarters. oh, God darn it. I looked up his name before. The guy who plays NoHo Hank.
Anthony Carrigan.
That's right. Anthony Carrigan was, because he's actually chilling at times.
Yeah.
And he's pleading and he loses his, like he goes from really funny to kind of scary.
That's right.
It 0 to 60. And
he does. And I think the show has hinted that that could happen.
Yeah, it has. But he's never quite pulled the trigger like this before.
Yeah. Almost literally.
Almost literally. Yeah, I thought the scene where he's like begging Cristobal not to go. I mean, we all know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we do. But does Cristobal know?
I don't know. I think he must, right? Because Hank keeps saying, you know too much, you know too much, you know too much. Don't leave.
Yeah, it seems as if at some point Hank might have said you know, they're going to kill you. But I guess he couldn't quite say that with them there. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was it. And it does seem like the show's going to do a massive, I say massive, it seems like it's like an 8-year time jump
mm-hmm.
to have Sally and Barry married with like a, I don't know, 8-year-old kid, 7-year-old kid, give or take.
I read Bill Hader said that the inspiration from the time jump came because they were curious what would happen if these characters got everything they wanted.
Wow.
Which I think is kind of an intriguing premise, right? Like the mm-hmm. show's gone almost as far as it can go.
Yeah. Huh. I didn't see it coming, but that final scene somehow seemed futuristic and bucolic at the same time.
Yeah. It was at first I thought it was a fantasy thing, right? Because it's so yes. clearly supposed to remind you of Barry's flashbacks.
That's it. Yeah.
It's clearly not.
Well, there's something to be said probably about his future looking a lot like his past when Fuchs mm-hmm. first met him. We suspected that this season would be darker, but ending up married to a known serial killer is pretty dark, I guess.
Pretty dark.
Getting what you want in some cases can be pretty dark.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I mean, I'm really intrigued by, like I said, by that premise, because it's like, what would Barry getting what he wants look like? He tries to use things as a replacement,
mm-hmm.
You know, to replace something that's missing in him. I think that he thinks that those things will redeem him, save him, whatever.
Yeah.
Sally's one of those things, and we'll see what happens.
If he does get everything he wants, that probably means Mr. Cousineau's next door as the grandfatherly figure to his kid now. I don't know.
I love you, Mr. Cousineau.
The father figure to Barry and the grandfather figure. How many episodes are left?
This was episode 4.
So is it?
I think they're doing 8.
Okay, so for like 4. Wow. They got room to do things, especially if they're going to stick with the time jump, which I think they're supposed to.
That's my understanding.
That's it.
That it's, yeah. And we'll see what happens to, it's really interesting. Well, maybe not really interesting. It was a good time to do a time jump because all these big things happened. And then we're going to get to see the fallout without any of the intervening stuff.
Right. You strip away the sort of mandatory grieving and things like that, which I've seen shows have so many problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
Just take something as simple as The Walking Dead. It's like so-and-so dies this episode. Okay, well, next week we have to spend a whole hour with someone crying about it. And it's just, it bogs things down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Barry would ever do that, but it certainly circumvents that kind of thing.
It does.
If I may, I'll take a little moment here. I want to shout out a commenter on our site, The Alabama Take. It was a very kind guy who left one. And I'm willing to bet he was the same person who also went on Apple Podcast and left a review that said, thanks for helping him sort through the show Beef. That was really cool. If you wish to do the same, by all means, head to thealabamatake.com and you can comment there. You can find us on Apple Podcast and just say, what about the episode you liked? Stuff like that's really cool to see, and I always love it. It's nice. Let's check in with the usual crew here. If you're new to the podcast with me, he's already given a lot of thoughts so far. He loves a damn book about a war. Donovan Reinwald.
Great to be here, Blaine.
Especially if it's a war you've never heard of.
Oh, man. English Civil War? I'm horny for it.
Gross.
And you just heard her. You've heard her earlier. She's becoming a fan favorite due to pictures of huskies on Instagram. It's Natalie Morrow.
I mean, if we start going with the video broadcast of this podcast, they will also be making mm-hmm. quite a showing there.
There you go. Usually our guy Adam Morrow is with us, but if you're a regular listener, you know he's wrapping up a European tour with the great Lee Baines and the Glory Fires. I bet they're in Spain discovering that there's more to life than guitars.
What else is there?
Each other.
Let's take a break, and on the other side we're going to talk Love and Death from HBO, HBO Max specifically, and then Somebody Somewhere. Of course, taking on sports, the Alabama Takes Premier Sports podcast has a heavy Alabama lean. That's what you want. But there's some serious, objectivity too. Join hosts TD and Greg every other Monday as they recap and break down the biggest news in college sports and beyond. Find it by searching Taken On Sports, minus the G, or head directly to the Alabama Take to stream it every other Monday. We're not an HBO affiliated podcast, believe it or not.
Are you sure?
I'm beginning to wonder. We're going to stick with HBO and HBO Max with the recent Max programming. It's the limited series Love and Death, which stars Jesse Plemons as a small-town Texan church member named Alan Gore. And he is prompted by fellow congregant Candy Montgomery, who's played by Elizabeth Olsen, to have an affair. The both of them are married to their respective spouses, and they're also members of the same church. One thing leads to another, based heavily on true events that happened in the small Texas town of Wiley in 1980. It was covered in Texas Monthly, which I haven't read.
I read it today after finishing.
Did you really?
I did. I was really interested.
That's cool. So spoiler alert for the first four episodes. That's all that have been aired, and that's what we'll probably get into. I was really disappointed to find out that Hulu did this same story.
With Jessica Biel.
I had no idea it existed.
Never heard of it.
Really?
And apparently... Yeah. No.
Oh.
Called Candy?
Yeah, I heard of it, but it just didn't seem that good, so I didn't watch it. This one, just the trailer alone is so much better that it's like, okay, I might actually try that.
Huh. That's so weird that I'd never heard of Candy. They went more character accurate with their look.
Yeah. Yeah, with the curly hair and 80s hair and all that kind of stuff, yeah. The glasses.
Yeah, here you got Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons just kind of sort of looking like themselves, except in 1980, maybe.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's fine. You're good. It's a dramatization. It doesn't matter.
Jesse Plemons always looks especially like himself in whatever he's into.
You're so. Not going to get away from that look.
You know, it's good.
I just found it a bit distracting for me because I kept thinking about the Candy Hulu series and thinking, how did they handle this? It's been a distraction mentally for me, but I'm going to give you your first question about Love and Death, HBO Max show. Why is Jesse Plemons so captivating?
God, is he?
Yes! I cannot stop looking at him when he's on screen. I'm like, what's he going to do? What's his reaction going to be to this?
He's so good, he never seems like he's acting, right? Like,
I think that's it, right?
He seems super... natural as any character he is, and he's played some wild characters, like everything from Doug to the cop in Game Night to this, and he, like, it's never flashy, it's always just like solid, and it, like everyone else, like you kind of look at it, like Elizabeth Olsen's very good, but also like she's acting. Jesse Plemons is just like you could tell me he's the actual guy, and I believe it.
Natalie, you know, he's not captivating to you.
I very much appreciated in this show when they said he was love proof or something like that. Yeah. And they just keep like subtly making fun of how he looks. Cause he's just like, it's not even that he's just like a normal looking dude. He is less than normal, but not in an interesting way. This is so mean. Cause this is an actual person. Like when you said you can't keep your eyes off of him, like it's cause he's just a weird looking dude. Like this isn't a good look. It's distracting. This is so mean. I'm sorry, Jesse Plemons.
Poor Jesse Plemons.
I do think he's average. Like he looks like somebody who would be teaching down the hall from me.
I like that.
A history teacher. Yeah, and he's just so... Yeah, I'm with Donovan. I think that answers my question. He has a natural ability to be scary, menacing, as he was on Breaking Bad.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy that, like, if I saw him in real life, I would be like, this guy gives me the creeps and I don't know why. So like in some roles that works, but then in others it's like I'm still just creeped out by you and I don't know why.
So does it work here? Is he supposed to be a little creepy in Love
and Death? I think he's just supposed to kind of just be clueless. A bumbling fool.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think a guy trying to do the right thing.
Pitifully so in episode 4.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the episodes. David E. Kelly is the producer. I think he writes a lot of these episodes too, or helps write them. His work dances on that border of being too much melodrama versus kind of sort of deep and interesting and well done. one of the things I think David E. Kelley gets a little wrong here is it's just too obvious to make Betty as a shrew in those opening two episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're dealing with the dramatization. The writers could have done something else, I think.
I was really interested to read about Betty's depiction in those Texas Monthly articles. And I think they're being pretty true to the articles because she doesn't come off in like a super great light. The articles, like a bunch of the and the stuff about, like, I think they say it in episode two, like Alan says, you know, this is the only time I feel like I'm not managing something's emotions, and we see him doing a lot of that. That came right from the article, which I thought was really interesting.
Wow. How long's the article?
It's in two parts. It's, I don't know how long it is because I read it on my phone.
Right. Well, I was going to say, I think I'm going to have to read these.
I probably took 30, 40 minutes to read it. And I guess it's all excerpts from the book that this is also based on.
Yeah, which I would read that maybe.
It was pretty well written. I was pretty interested.
But I think I needed something in the show to humanize Betty.
Mm-hmm.
Because when she does get killed in episode four, I didn't feel a lot other than panic for Elizabeth Olsen's character, Candy. I just like, you know, you spend so much time with Candy, you naturally going to say, oh, God, get out of there. Don't get caught. You kind of mentally do that, even though you know it's wrong. But she's just one of the protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Is Betty a human or was she just a cardboard figure for you?
I mean, I think it didn't bother me because, I mean, if you know anything, you know how the story ends.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, how could we have that information? This is a woman who is no longer alive. Like, Candy is still alive. Old husband dude is still alive. Like, they've been able to tell their stories and what happened. Whereas you can't just fill in the gap. I mean, you can, but that's fiction to fill in the gaps for.
No, well, yeah, it would have had to have been fiction. It would have.
Which I think this story, I read an article that was a comparison of the two, of Love and Death and of Candy. And that was one of the big differences is they put a lot more narrative for, I can't remember her name. They added more to that story than Love and Death did because it is more of a more dramatization, more of a.
Those first two episodes really felt drawn out to me.
Yeah, dear, all of these episodes feel like 2 hours.
It's true. They do feel really long. Like, I'm not enjoying myself.
Or that's true.
As much as I can. Like, I'm not sitting there like I'm so bored or looking at my phone or whatever, but they feel really long. And there comes a point like 35 or 40 minutes in where every shot, I'm like, is this the final scene?
Mm-hmm.
Like, every single time they do a scene break.
And I'm not advocating for them to be, you know, 30 minutes, but I think a nice 45 to 50 minutes is good because there are two episodes there that are like the full hour, 60 minutes. And I'm curious that it's a little drawn out in that way, yet they choose not to maybe just have a 2-minute scene where Betty's hugging her daughter or something. Just something to give me like, okay, she was a human. But, you know, like Natalie said, the focus is about the murder. And I didn't know a lot coming in at all. I assumed she was going to murder Alan.
That Candy would murder Alan?
Uh-huh. I thought maybe he wanted to break it off and she murders him in one of the hotel rooms. That's what I thought was coming.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
No, I didn't know anything. And I sure as shit didn't know there were women pastors in the late 70s.
That was honestly a surprise to me. I was like, what denomination are they supposed to be?
So is Methodist, right?
Yeah, they're Methodist.
Is that true?
That they were Methodist? Yeah.
No, that there were women pastors in the late 70s in the Methodist church.
More liberal Methodist churches, yeah.
Okay. I went to a very strict Methodist, which was pretty much Baptist, you might as well say. I was pleased to see Kristen Ritter and Patrick Fugit. I love both of them. It's so great that they're getting more screen time in the last couple of episodes, especially the Patrick Fugit's character of...
Pat? Was his name Pat?
Is it Pat?
I think it is.
Yeah. Yep. Of course it's Pat.
Pat Montgomery.
What other name would he be other than Pat Montgomery? Wow, did they get a perfect role for him. He's so good in that kind of role. And of course, you guys know, our listeners will know, he's the boy in Almost Famous. And it's just, I love seeing him.
That was just honestly hard for me. That was so distracting the whole time. So I was like, you're a child. Why are you acting like an old man?
Yeah. He plays the just typical, average, boring husband so perfectly. And just in case any of our younger listeners want to know, men really did wear brown socks and shorts to mow the yard. True. Totally happened in the 80s. I saw it with my own
eyes. They've had a couple shots of that where it's like the legs first, or the feet, then the legs, then the shorts.
Somebody really mowing the yard too. They really want to give you the sense that this guy mows his yard.
He's just a regular guy.
Yeah. See, they've humanized him nicely just with those shots.
Did you think that the marriage encounter stuff where Betty is really sharing her feelings and they kind of, that didn't humanize her more for you?
A little worked for me. It did, but I don't know. She still felt a little shrewd, even in those moments.
Maybe she was.
That's true. She might have been in real life too. And I think the emotional impact is coming from Jesse Plemons' reaction in this fourth episode where,
oh man, yeah.
It's really sad to see him tell his daughter.
Yeah.
And that's a gut punch, really. And it's kind of sad in a different way that it took late into the third episode for this story to gain some steam.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it kind of goes with, like, these episodes felt really long. The first two, it was like, okay, I get it. They're having an affair.
they pushed that.
And I wasn't bored. Like, I wanted to watch it. Right, it doesn't really get kicked. I mean, it's good, and it sets the table really well. Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons are very good together. You can kind of see like what they're both getting out of it. But yeah, like it really shifts into high gear when it's like, what is going to happen now? Now that this thing that can't be undone has been done, and she's trying to hide it.
Yeah, the series goes 7 episodes, and I was really curious as to how they're going to get 3 more episodes out of the rest of. Again, me not knowing anything, coming in completely blind. What could they get out of it?
Well, she does go to trial, so they'll probably have that. The guy, the lawyer at her church, that's her trial lawyer.
Who's an interesting character actor? He was in Natalie. Did you watch Iron Fist?
No.
Yeah, he's in that, and he's good in it.
Huh?
He's good. He's a pretty good actor. I liked seeing him when I see him on screen, and I just remember him. He was in a lot of those episodes of Iron Fist. He had a big role. It's funny that I think Elizabeth Olsen's overselling a lot, but I think it's because she's using that to show that Candy oversells. Mm-hmm. Like, Candy has to be boisterous and big to hide some of her demons. Long before she does any sort of murderous axe chopping, she, you know, is trying to be, look how good I am, and over the top. Because when I first saw it, I thought, my first thoughts was that she was doing a bit much, but then I started thinking, oh, I think she's doing that on purpose.
I say, don't we all know women who do that?
Yeah.
It's just a very Southern thing.
It really is. Especially in that time period, I felt like it was even more.
And this is, maybe I'm wrong, because it depends on where the next 3 episodes or so go. But I do think that it was a little bit too to like build it up more so that when it all unravels, it's that much more compelling, you know, dramatic when she can't be perfect anymore, when she doesn't do the right thing.
Nice use of using the classic filming technique of the door frames. Mm-hmm. Like in episodes 3 and 4, there are more door frames to give you that claustrophobic feeling of entrapment. I'm a sucker for a on the nose moment that, hey, we're in the early 80s here when you got the baby riding up front in the pickup truck. It's like, yeah, that's what I grew up with. That's what I've got for Love and Death. It's not horrible by any stretch. It's pretty good, but sometimes it's just the actors that are making me really want to watch it.
I think that would be my overall review too, where it's like if this was done, like it's fine, right? Like it's fine in the way that a lot of stuff that's like prestige TV or something that has the trappings of prestige TV are often fine, where it's they kind of know how to walk the walk, maybe not talk the talk, but maybe not quite walk the walk with different actors, because they have a lot of really good actors in this. I think with different actors, I wouldn't be as compelled, because I do want to see what happens now.
I agree. Even the little squirmy preacher is He's sort of a known actor.
What is it, Pastor Ray? Is that his name?
Boy, they hate his ass, don't they?
No puppet shows.
I mean, who doesn't want a puppet show?
I just loved, this is neither here nor there, but there's, Pat just nails the line where he's like, you know, when she leaves for the weekend or whatever, and he's like, she's gone to strengthen her commitment to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and I'm very proud of her. Nails it.
We just talked about somebody somewhere last week, but I think we'll it warrants a bit of a talk, short little talk here at the end of our episode. Natalie pointed out we probably want to discuss this one.
I remember nothing about this episode except for the end. Oh, really? Except for the end.
That's why I'm here.
You know, that was one of those scenes where it's like, is this too much? And at first it's too much, and by the end it's just perfect.
Oh, yeah.
I was crying.
Yeah. We'll spoil the second episode in case you don't know what we're talking about. So it's Poker Night with Fred Rococo.
Fred Rococo.
He's one of my favorites. It's Poker Night at his basement. And suddenly he has a fiance just show up.
That he's never told anyone about.
Don't you love the reactions there where Sam's just like, who the hell is this? But it does create this, I think what's going to probably be the motifs of the season, where Sam and Joel are doubting themselves because of where they've been. So, you know, you're kind of moving away from the grief of the first season. But Sam's been asked to sing at the wedding. Joel's been asked to basically officiate, or whatever you want to call the wedding. I guess officiate would be right.
Yeah, officiate.
Yeah. Joel's going to do the ceremony. And so we get that inner turmoil. This show does cool things with inner turmoil. And that, I think that's our, maybe not, we're only in the second episode, but that does seem like it'll be a part of what they'll examine with some of these characters this year.
The other person that immediately springs to mind when you said inner turmoil is it Trisha, the sister?
That's right.
She's definitely more, she was a big part of the first season, mm-hmm. but at least, maybe I'm wrong, but my impression is that she's more front and center, at least in these first two episodes. You know, she was sort of Sam's foil in the first season. Mm-hmm. And now they're both dealing with maybe not quite knowing what is going on in their own ways.
Bit of renewal.
Yeah.
Kind of sad that Trisha doesn't have her store anymore and she's working in a
Walmart.
In a, yeah, like a Walmart type place, or like a Hobby Lobby kind of place where she would be doing a similar thing, but for a corporate entity. That was sad.
Customers can't even get her name right. That's, she's wearing a name tag.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sam's going to seek out her old, piano and performance teacher? Kind of, and looks as though Joel's going to have to dip back into his time as a church-going guy and figure out what is it we can take from the past and use for the present. Could be cool. Could be an interesting concept. But this is now the show where Joel and Sam are intimate as friends by simultaneously having epic diarrhea on the phone. What's the line? It's gross, but it's good.
Isn't that, we've all experienced that,
yes,
in a meal. It's gross, but it's good.
Oh, yeah.
It's gross, but it's good. Yep.
Oh, I thought you meant we've all experienced just epic diarrhea. Well, because,
I mean,
of a
meal. If we're being honest with ourselves, yeah.
What killed me was the accuracy of the pauses. Like, oh, I'm fine now. I'm fine. Oh no, I'm not.
How did they film this? That's what I want to know. The behind the scenes. How did they capture this?
Every time they hit mute. Like, they just nailed it. Just, yeah. You know, like, and then they have to resume having a normal conversation.
And then Sam doesn't hit mute. It's a, yeah. I'm with Don on effort. My first watch or my first few minutes with this scene, I thought, my God, this, I don't know if this is that funny. And then I was like, no, it's pretty funny now. But just the pauses is what kept getting me.
That was what, like, by the end of the scene, it was like, this is the funniest thing that the show has
ever. Well, they were doing the candy thing. The like, but like overdue, like, oh, I'm just fine, I'm great, you know?
Yes. And then like, oh Jesus, I'm not.
Very Midwestern and Southern thing, I guess, to play like you're okay. I did wonder though, in those first few minutes, like, is this in tune with the show, but it's in tune with Sam and Joel is what it's in tune with. Maybe not the show is what it's done before.
Yeah, I keep thinking about, especially watching Love and Death, when Natalie said, I think, guess it was last week, about how it's people don't laugh on TV together.
Oh, that's right.
And Sam and Joel do.
Yeah.
And it feels, and now watching Love and Death, the only person who laughs is Pat, and only one who's watching The Love Boat.
poor Pat.
but I think that that was, like you said, it's true to Sam and Joel that, like, we have seen them building on this relationship. They obviously enjoy each other. They're laughing together. And even at this moment, they're still laughing together.
Do you kind of envy that? Like, do you want to have that kind of relationship with somebody that you could make that phone call?
I think I do maybe have that.
I don't think I have it, but I kind of want it. You know?
I think maybe. Wasn't the episode called Number Two?
Yeah. Second episode, Number Two.
Episode number two.
All leading up to it.
I'll backtrack a bit and then we'll put a bow on this episode and our podcast episode. Them making fun of the guy who was way too old to be in singing classes and performing with the kids. I thought that was cruel, but then at the same time, I thought it was very, very funny.
See, that guy could have been played by Jesse Plemons and I would have bought it.
Oh, yeah. If they could have gotten a cameo from Jesse Plemons on that, oh my goodness. This show would have been one of my favorites of all time. Somebody somewhere, though, with that kind of crazy, outrageous potty humor, it's destiny that next week's going to be a gut punch of some sort, probably. An emotional
absolutely
thing, because they do that. Well, let's put a bow on our show. We've enjoyed ourselves. We hope you have. That's the end. Find us online on Twitter, Instagram, by Taking It Down Pod. And then the Alabama Take, our website and production company, so to speak, is pretty much everywhere. Go find us at the Alabama Take and say hello, leave us a review. We'll talk to everyone next Tuesday.